Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
Okay, here we go. I'm standing. And thanks for making the change of location work for everybody. This is class two of the speed bumps discussion. And hopefully the sound is good, even though we're in kind of an awkward space because the shul's being renovated at the moment. I think I started last week with a similar sentiment, but I've been thinking about this idea and I want to repeat it if I did start last week this way. And the idea is that gathering for a purpose like this purpose is a very great thing. It reflects beautifully upon the people who have come together that are asking questions about how can we continue to lift ourselves up. How do we deal with the challenges of it? I mentioned last week that there's a concept that some people refer to, that at least one book refers to as after the return. And I'm not sure that there is something called after the return. Because after the return implies that there's a threshold, an arrival, and then something new. But I would argue that there's no arrival. If that makes you uncomfortable, I apologize, but I think that is when we face the idea that we don't ever really arrive at the destination of our Yiddishkeit. You don't ever really arrive at the destination of our development. The only time you arrive at the destination of your development is when your time is up.
When you die.
Okay, exactly. So once we get that, though, then maybe some of the things that we figured, once I get there, X, Y, Z, I'll feel certain things, become debunked because there is no once I get there on some measure. So, and yet, I can imagine that for some, that's a scary or almost depressing idea. What do you mean? I can never get there, so then what's the point? But the point is the growth. The point is the development. Sydney, I printed it, and then it's in the shul, and I left it there. But you sent me such a beautiful quotation. I think I have it right. Let me see if I can get it right in my head. You'll correct me if I'm wrong. And after last week's class, Sydney sent me, he had received an email. He said, this line in there is reflecting on what we spoke about. It was the quotation of the day. I don't remember what the source was, and it said, you haven't made it this far, only to make it this far. Was that the idea? Yeah. You haven't made it this far, only to make it this far. Meaning that you have developed yourself. And the purpose of the development of yourself is to further develop yourself. And that's really probably true in all of life, except for maybe financial well-being. You can just say, okay, I'm done. Get off. It's fine. Most people who have enough don't say, I have enough. Right? But you can say, I have enough in that. But you can't really ever say, I have enough health. You have to continue to take care of yourself, right? So certainly there's a concept that I learned early on in my own. But this is an important thing, by the way. You should know that I myself made dramatic religious changes in my life also. So a lot of times, and I'm going to talk about this in depth a little bit now, a lot of times people think, well, this such and such person, they've always been X or Y. That's probably never true about anybody. It's definitely not true about me, but it's probably never true about anybody because it doesn't work like that. So somebody told me many, many years ago, it might have been my Rebbe, high school Rebbe, Eugen Zichrono Livracha, but I think it might have been him. But many years ago already, I learned the idea that the concept of the angels that we spoke about last week, on last week's parsha, going up and down the ladder, is that the verse tells us that there's a sulam, mutzav arzo, verosho magia hashamayma. There's a ladder firmly ensconced in the ground, and its head is going to the heavens, like we spoke about last week. And then at the end it says that the malachim, the angels, are olim v'yordimbo. They're going up and they're going down. That's also true, but that's not my vort here. Okay, this is the idea. Bizman she'inam olim yordim. At the time that they're not going up, they're going down. There is no such thing as stagnation. There is no such thing as they are present and not moving. And that's true about all of us. That's true about all of us. So I want to share with you an idea that I consider so fundamental and so central to a person's life and a person's understanding of what is incumbent upon himself or herself any day of your life. It's a concept that was developed, written by Rav Dessler. Rav Dessler, Rav Eliyahu Dessler, was a prominent ethicist and philosopher and yeshiva teacher in the middle of the 20th century in England and in Israel. He was part of the Gateshead Yeshiva in England and then part of the Panovich Yeshiva in Bnei Brak. And after his life, they published his works in a what was originally, I don't know, I think it came out over time, but when I got involved with it, it was 4 volumes. Now it's 5. It's called Michtav Me'Eliyahu, literally translated as a letter from Elijah, from Eliyahu, that was his name. And it's translated, parts of it are translated into English under the title Strive for Truth. Okay, so the wonderful book's called Strive for Truth. So Rav Dessler spoke about an idea, it's recorded in his first volume, page 113 in the Hebrew, called Nekudat HaBechira, or Nekudas HaBechira, the choosing point. This is such an amazing thing that I would like to read it to you in my own translation from his writing. Amazing idea. He says as follows. When two nations are at war, the war is at the place of its waging. Whatever is on the other side of one given army is all in its control. And there's no opposition there. And that means if the war is being fought, let's say during the Civil War, the United States was being fought in the middle of the country. There was no actual war being fought in Boston or in, I guess, I don't even know where, maybe Tallahassee or whatever. You know, the war was being fought along the Maryland, Virginia, you know, Pennsylvania continuum. One would think that's where the armies meet. A lot of people don't know that Maryland was part of the South. So that's why it's called the Old Line State. So you can take that trivia back home with you tonight. Okay, so now, whatever belongs to, whatever is behind one front belongs to them. There's no opposition there. And similarly, behind the other army, that's all in the possession of the other army. If one will win in war and push the other one some distance, then in the new war, they will be in a new place where they're now currently standing. So if we push the enemy back, then now the war has gone 20 miles further on, and where it had been is no longer at war. But the place, sorry, I'm repeating now, but the place that they had been in before, now there's no war there, because now it is owned by the conquering people. Therefore, in reality, there is only one front. But in potential, all sides that are on either side of the war front are in potential part of the war. But in reality, right now, there's only one war front. But what's behind my group is potentially part of the war front if you push me back. What's behind you, if I push you back, is also part of the war front, potentially. But right now, it's not actual. So it is regarding choice, free will, decisions. Every person has bechira, has decisions, has free will. That means to say that at the point where his grasp of truth and that which he fights with, that seems to him like maybe it's true, the birthplace of sheker, of lack of truth, of lack, or we might call it at the place of where his integrity is tested, at the point where maybe I won't act with integrity at that point. That's where the war is. Most things are where there is no meeting point of truth and untruth. Much of the truth that a person does, he's already been educated to do all the time. And it does not even come into his mind to do something different. And there's much bad and impropriety that a person does that he there is also not being tested at all because he never has any thought that I shouldn't do it. The choosing point is only at the point where the army of the good inclination and the army of the evil inclination are fighting. I'm almost done with the quotation. Many people, for example, he says, speak lashon hara. They speak things they shouldn't say. They say not nice things about other people. Why? Because that's what they're used to doing. It doesn't even enter their mind that it's bad. Those people, they have no yetzahara, no evil inclination, he says, to desecrate the Shabbos, to negate davening, to not wear tzitzis or tefillin, and similar things. That is because regarding, in that person's case, Shabbos, tefillin, tzitzis, and so on, he's already educated, he's got used to do these things, and therefore the yetzahara, the evil inclination, doesn't wage war there at all. Okay, now I want to take this a step further. Just about in every area of our lives, every person is at a choosing point. You know, I learn each night after Maariv, the late Maariv, due to Jamie Kaplan's inspiration, we learn 5 minutes of the laws of Lashon Hara. I can tell you that as half a joke, it's ruining my life. In other words, you allow that birdie to just go and die. You don't like to think about it too much, the one that's on your shoulder. And then you're studying every night about what's allowed to say and what's not allowed to say. And you're like, oh, man, now all day you're thinking, oh, should I say that? Should I not say that? Should I listen to that? Should I not listen to that? And so on and so forth. It's a more convenient truth for us to just say, I don't want to think about that at all. Okay, so, but it's a great thing when you allow into your world that I now have a new choosing point. Because what was happening in the war of the words coming out of my mouth, I was waging war maybe on, I'll give you an example. I don't really, Kenainahar, I hope I never have a problem with this. I don't really feel at risk of, in public, blurting out a word that's inappropriate that should come out of my mouth. Okay? Like I don't hold in curse words. They don't come to my mouth. It doesn't mean they don't come to my head. It doesn't mean that when I'm alone, I don't maybe have such a test. But I don't have a test regarding that. I don't have a test regarding, a perfect example. I have absolutely no test about going to get a cheeseburger at McDonald's. It's a non-test issue for me. But there are areas within eating where in other words, that's not in my choosing point. I'm not choosing that yes or no. Does it mean I'm not choosing at all? No, I'm choosing all the time. I'm choosing, for example, about whether to overeat and indulge in kosher food. That's a choosing point to deal with that. Because the moment that you do that, there is an element of wrongdoing there that you're just self-serving. I'm choosing maybe, or a person might, this actually doesn't apply to me in specific, but a person may say, do I really have to wait that long I had the fleishigs already? You know, now there is a temptation because the ice cream looks good and whatever it is, and I already did this much time or whatever it is, so now the choosing point is there. They're not choosing on the cheeseburger at all, but they're choosing along a different part of the fight. Now here's the amazing thing. And this is, he continues, and I'm not going to read it inside. When you make good choices, you move the choosing point up. When you make bad choices, you move the choosing point down. Amazing thing. There are decisions in my life that used to be humongous tests in my life. Like when I was 17, 18, 19, 20, whatever it may be. They're behind me. They're just totally behind me. You know, like, I'll give you an example. There's not a chance that I would decide, like, on purpose, not to daven Maariv on a given evening. Me, personally, where I'm holding. That's not going to happen. That has not happened in decades. That particular behavior in specific was also not a choosing point when I was in high school. On the other side of the choosing point. In other words, there was not a chance that I would daven Maariv. It wasn't a matter of conscience for me. It was not a matter of conscience for me. I didn't like think, oh, I'm supposed to, but I'd rather watch the game. No, it was just not on my schedule. I wasn't one of those kinds of Jews, if you will. Okay? But the choosing point has moved. So now the choosing point for me regarding Maariv is intent, focus. Maybe the choosing point for me in Maariv is never missing the minyan. Maybe the choosing point for me in Maariv is davening early when the night has happened already, when I know I'm not going to get a minyan, because the halacha requires that you not get lost and go. And I know I'm talking up in the stratosphere on purpose, okay? Because I don't want to make anybody nervous. I want to talk something that's a little bit further away. Everybody has a choosing point in every element of your own development. Even the people you think are most righteous. By the way, in the privacy of their own lives, the people that you think are the most righteous may have choosing points that you would never believe. Oh my God, you would never believe that person has such and such temptation. And people have temptations. What can we do? That's a reality of life. And what I'm really trying to point out here is that we have been placed into a war. It's the evil inclination against the good inclination. We've been placed into the war. We against our will. Like it says in the Shemoneh Esrei on Yom Kippur, like against your will you were born, and against your will, God forbid. Against your will, you've been placed into a war. And the question is, I think I said this last week, there are some people who have no choices. They make no choices because they've determined that whatever I feel like doing is all I'm going to do. But that's not what you're doing here. You're looking for a life of greater integrity, greater positivity, greater contribution, greater discipline. And we're all making choices. And I promise you, in many areas of life, my choosing point is lower than yours. Okay? And in some areas of life, my choosing point is higher than yours. And we're all our own unique cocktail. Maybe it's harder for me to be honest in business dealings than it is for you. Maybe it's harder for me to be, like, this is a big cocktail life. Lots of inputs, lots of areas, right? So my choosing point as a dad may be way lower than your choosing point as a dad. You may be a far more developed father in terms of how you take care of your kinderlach than I am. And I'm trying to grow in that area. And so on and so forth. We're all making choices. We haven't arrived. We're all making choices, and the reward you get for making good choices is you move the choosing point up. That's the power of mitzvah. The mitzvah, goreris mitzvah, one command, one positive deed causes another, and we should know from it the opposite is true also. So that when you start to cave and give into the Yetzer Hara, and you go, oh, then I'll be more settled. You won't be more settled. Choosing points move down, and you'll still be, and there's more temptation below that temptation, and you just keep diving. Because the choosing points are always moving in our lives. Okay, I've spoken a lot. Let's hear what you have to say about this important idea. Don't you know when you make bad choices? I don't know, there's something called the conscience, and it tells us, right, that we make bad choices. Sometimes we know the definition of good and bad. It's a very important idea, by the way. Sometimes we know the definition of good and bad, and sometimes we don't. Sometimes we ignore wanting to know the definition of good and bad, because we feel more cozy there. But that, by the way, is the choosing point in that particular discipline. I'm choosing not to study more about it. So that I don't have to have the birdie chirping in my ear, don't say that, don't listen to that. Right? So I think we know, but I may have mentioned this last week, I speak about this all the time. The Mishnah says in Pirkei Avos, the sixth Mishnah in the beginning of Pirkei Avos says, make for yourself a teacher and acquire for yourself a friend. The notion of not living life alone. When you live alone, you are subject to all of your own bribes. The primary bribes we have in life are comfort, honor, and temptation. This must be okay, because I want it. Right? This is good enough, because like this, I only have to get up at this time. I don't have to get up an hour earlier.
It's rationalization.
Right, it's rationalization. So the thing is that I don't really care that much about you getting an extra hour of sleep. It's you who care about it. So if you have friends, then they catch you in those lies. And if you have good friends and you open yourself to them, they'll say to you, and you'll say to them, I have this all the time. I want you to know something. I have this all the time. Today, my wife and I had a meaningful and important conversation about something that is, I think, meaningful and does put added stress on our family. And I think it's a meaningful contribution that we should do. I think it's a course of action we should take, but it's uncomfortable. And she felt that it was too uncomfortable. So how do you deal with that?
Compromise.
It's one option is compromise, and it's ultimately a great, important technique. In our case, what we agreed to was, we will ask this question to third party X. Okay? Happens to be, in this case, we're going to ask my father-in-law, and I'm going to talk to him tomorrow morning at 9 about it. Because we have a wonderful, meaningful, close relationship that we're in which we all trust each other. And so he functions as a Rebbe to us in the particular realm that we're talking about. If it was a different realm, she might have said, please call Rabbi Hopfer in Baltimore. She might have said, let's talk to the Rebbe about it. She might have said, you know, we would have agreed. That's how we approach a lot of things. Aseh lecha rav uknei lecha chaver. Make for yourself a teacher and acquire for yourself a friend. Very crucial to finding out the difference between right and wrong. Because, frankly, we're both subject to our own bribes. Let me explain. In the case we're talking about, I might get more honor if we take this course of action. And she will get more inconvenience. Okay? But I'm not doing it for the honor. And she's not doing it to avoid inconvenience. But maybe we are. Maybe we can't really tell. Maybe we don't know ourselves. Maybe we're lying to ourselves. So it requires third-party guidance. But a lot of things you know when you're doing things wrong. You know yourself. And you know when you're doing things right. Let's not focus only on the bad. You know when you're doing things right. And you know when you've lifted yourself up. When you've put things behind you. Friends, you, every one of you has put miles and miles of choosing points behind you already. That's an amazing thing. Think about yourself and just snapshot. You choose the year. 1980, 1970, 1995, 2002, whatever it is. You choose the point and you go, me now versus me then. How did I get here? What am I doing here? I'm an imposter. You know, but that's not true. You've made amazing decisions that are now very, very far behind you. Right? So like, for me, temptations of when I was in high school, let's say things I did that I now think I shouldn't have done, maybe I haven't done them literally in 25 years. That's good. It's just miles behind me. But I have new things to grow in. Right? And hopefully I continue to develop so that 5 years from now I say, whew, those things I was choosing at 5 years ago, that's beneath me. I'm well advanced beyond that. Okay, next question. Yes, sir.
My ability to read Hebrew is far from perfect.
Okay.
And sometimes I fall way behind as they daven in jet speed.
Okay.
And I have to decide whether I'm going to switch 20 pages forward or try to complete what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
It's a decision. I know I'm... Am I wrong? Am I right? What should I do?
Okay, did everybody hear the question?
No.
Okay, so the question was, sometimes I'm davening, I'm in shul, and I'm not keeping pace with the chazan and the rest of the people there. I'm falling behind, and I have a decision in front of me. Should I skip ahead to where they are, or should I continue ahead at my pace? Okay, and what's the right thing to do? Did I repeat the question correctly? What do you say? What's the right thing to do, Rabbi Avraham?
Everybody different. I try with the chazan.
So everybody's different?
Yeah.
You choose. What makes you right? What makes you
right? Because I want to be with everybody.
So you feel you want to be with everybody. Yes, Paula?
Doesn't halakha state that it's especially, like, at least in the Amida anyways, that you're supposed to be with the chazan.
Okay, very good. Doesn't halacha state that when you are, at least in the Amida, you're supposed to be with the chazan?
Yeah.
Okay, I don't want to answer your question, but your question was so delicious. Okay? Because I want to tell you something very important, because I think you asked the right question. Regardless of whether the conclusion is yes or no, you asked the right question, which is, what's the halacha? This has been studied for centuries. You know, Mr. Avraham over here, we schmoozed last night for a long time in a store. And we've met each other over the years a couple different times. We never really got to know each other until an hour neither of us had in Walmart last night. Okay? But he's a Haim Shayid from the house, from childhood. So I'm going to tell you something that is especially for you. Okay? Should we leave this decision to boich svaras? It's like some svara that's coming right from my boich. Is I feel like this? I feel it? Or does the law govern? Is there something that says this is the right thing to do and this is the right and this is the wrong thing to do? So I'm going to give you a complicated answer. It's entirely dependent on what part of davening you're in. Mm-hmm. If you're in this part of davening, then you're not even allowed to skip ahead. You've got to follow the procedure that's there. And that's because you've opened a system that isn't closed. It's like a surgeon. Oh, we're falling behind, so we opened him up. We don't have time to close him. Right? Not available. Right? A musician, probably, when you have the perfect piece, you don't really have time to break up, you know, Rhapsody in Blue or whatever it is. You don't have time to... But you might decide either to skip a piece or even maybe the drastic idea of skipping a movement within a piece because the young musician can't handle it or because whatever. You have to make decisions about that, right? But you can't just in the middle of the high suddenly start someplace else. It doesn't make sense. You have to transition properly. So it depends on the discipline. It depends on the space in the davening. It depends on what's going on here. If you said the bracha before Hallel and you didn't say the bracha at the end of Hallel, you can't skip parts of Hallel because it's one unit and system. But I'm not going to go through all the halachas. What I will encourage is that's a perfect example of how we have to be learning. Because once you learn about it, it becomes second nature to you. When are we in systems and when are we not in systems? When are we in something that can't be? And then sometimes it is how I feel. Sometimes it's like it's not governed by, or it's how much I feel I can catch up, or I'm not getting meaning from this. By the way, friends, sometimes davening is too long for me. It's too long for me. So you didn't really hear this from the rabbi, but there's kind of kosher ways to take a break if it's too long for you. Depends on what part it is. Depends on a lot of factors. Let's put it like that. We got to learn. We have to learn. In some of the elements, there'll be differences between men and women in terms of obligation and in terms of, therefore, how the systems apply and so on and so forth. So I'm not giving you a full answer. What I'm giving you, what I loved about your question was that sometimes the question comes, what's the halacha? Now, the halacha is not random. It's been developed over centuries and millennia based on actual, like I said, perfect examples. The surgeon can't stop before closing the body. He can, I'm sure, I imagine, turn the closing of the body over to the PA. Okay, and say,
they do that all the time.
Yeah, you know how to do this. Do it under my supervision so that I might even be doing paperwork that you are not legally allowed to do or whatever it may be. So there's a lot of wisdom in all that, and it's not arbitrary, and it doesn't just come from my feelings sometimes. Sometimes it does. Yeah. Wait, one thing before you go. Did I answer your question comprehensively enough? Okay. Yes, go ahead.
Does kavanah come into this also, whether it's the davening and you're listening to where the kavanah is, or where the person next to you is, or something, then you're not deeply enough trying to be involved in what you're davening.
Okay, so...
That you don't want to...
I think I've already heard the question, but let's translate the opening word, which is intent. proper focus, right? You use the word kavanah, but just for the benefit of those who might not have understood the word. So the answer, you're touching on something really big, okay? Which is the interplay of group dynamic and individual dynamic. I actually gave a class about this last year in the opposites series. We have something on this Yachid and Rabim of individual and group. And we have a whole lecture on it. But I think it's very important to understand. You know, my son became bar mitzvah last week. No, it's 3 weeks ago already, actually, that he really became bar mitzvah. So he's 13 years old. And I read online, I don't even remember how, I was looking for a certain quotation where it was in the Gemara, so I searched something, and I found this article, and it happens to be that, like, some of the, if you read articles, and it's within the area of your own expertise, so you see that not everything on the internet is correct. Okay? So, there was a fiction written in this article that, according to Torah law, again, fiction, this is not true. According to Torah law, a boy becomes bar mitzvah at 20. But the rabbis changed it to 13. Okay? That's a sheker, that's a lie. Okay, that's not accurate. But that's what the writer wrote.
It's fake news.
It's fake news. Yeah, exactly, it's fake news. So, but what is that writer talking about in their mistake? Okay? What that writer is talking about is that when you read the Chumash, you see that it isn't until 20 that somebody leaves to go to the army and is counted in the census. It isn't until 20 that somebody works in the service of the temple on some elements of the service of the temple. There is no mention of 13. But we understand that the rabbinic tradition, the oral tradition of the Torah, is every bit the same level as the written things. We could have a whole discussion about that, by the way, and it's an important one. I'll give you just a little bit on that. Very crucial. We live our lives according to oral transmission. And people argue, well, what? But it writes in the Torah this or that. Do not believe the fallacy that oral transmission is any less than the written. And here's a little proof, a little something to think about this week about it. If I ask you to read to me the first verse of the Torah, and you see that the first word says Bereshit. Bet, Resh, Aleph, Shin, Yud, Tav. And you tell me it says Bereshit, and I say, no, it says Alabama. You say, it doesn't say Alabama, it says Bereshit. I say, no, it says Alabama. You say, no, it says Bereshit. So I turn to you and I say, how do you know it says Bereshit? I said, because my teacher told me that the thing that's shaped like that makes a B sound, and the one that's shaped like that makes an R sound, and the three-headed monster makes a Sh sound. I said, well, my teacher told me that it makes an A, La, Ba, Ma sound. You're Meshuga, Shoshan. Well, no, we just have a different oral transmission. The only way you know how to read it is because of the oral tradition of what that artwork means. What does that ink, shaped like that, make a sound? And what does the word mean? That itself is oral tradition. How to pronounce written words is a form of oral tradition. So that, for a moment, just debunks the idea that there could be something called written without oral tradition. Because the ability to read is dependent on the transmission orally of how to read things. Okay. In fact, the Talmud says this. The Talmud says that one of the potential convert came to Hillel in the famous stories. You know, everybody knows the one famous story, tell me everything while I stand there on one foot. But there in Gemara and Shabbos, one of the stories is that he says, teach me only the written Torah. No, he says, convert me on the condition that you teach me only the written transmission, only the written Torah. So he tells him the first day that Aleph makes the A sound, and Bet makes the B sound, and Gimel makes the Gimel sound. He says, that's our lesson for today, leave. So the next day he comes back, he says, okay, lesson of the day is that the first one makes the G sound, and the second one makes the A sound, and the third one makes the B sound. She says, what are you talking? That's not true. You told me yesterday the opposite. He said, aha. Must be there that we have to have an oral tradition around how things are written. The Talmud says it. Okay, so now back to the wrench. Actually, 13 is the time that a boy becomes bar mitzvah. On an individual level. That does not mean, that does not mean that he carries the burden of the Jewish people yet. To carry the burden of the Jewish people, you have to be 20. So now you might ask me, then why does he get to be the chazan at the age of 13? It's a reasonable question. Because that's dependent on obligations, not really dependent on the actual carrying the burden of the people. But by the way, no one would have a 13-year-old lead davening on Rosh Hashanah or Yom Kippur. You wouldn't feel good about that. You went into shul, and you got this 14-year-old whippersnapper, you know, getting up to say, hinani ha'ani mimas. You know, that's not going to work for you. You're going to say, that's not for me. So, and in fact, the Talmud says, these are the rules about that guy. He should be this, he should be that, he should be pious, he should be married, he should have children, or whatever. There are rules about that. So, what I'm trying to point out is, and when you come to the davening is probably our number one example in our lives of the intermingling of the individual in his own dynamic and as a member of the congregation. That's a very big idea. Ironically, the bigger the Jewish community, very often the less communal dynamic they have. Because everyone chaps a minyan. I go and I daven here in the morning because it's the most convenient time, and there in the afternoon because it's the best time, and then I'll go to Itzkovich in the middle of the night in Bnei Brak for Maariv because they have minyanim every 5 seconds. You know, and my brother told me that in his community, he davens in his shul every day. He lives in Beit Shemesh. He davens in his shul every day. But many people do as they, you know, they daven in their shul Shabbos morning, but otherwise they go where it's convenient. He says you could literally have a young man, he comes into the shtiblach, where it's wherever it's convenient, you know, shows up one morning, then in those kinds of shuls where it's not really anybody's shul, we're just all here, what we're really joining together is we're not joining as a community, we're joining as a whole bunch of individuals who are fulfilling communal obligations not as a community. We have no dynamic that we share. Just somebody has to be the chazan, so you jump up. Oh, you're a mourner, you get to jump up. Whatever, so he says, you'll have in those kind of shuls, they sell the aliyahs. There's no way to give out the aliyahs. So in order to make a few pennies, they say, you know, the three aliyahs, whoever wants to give 5 shekel, he gets to choose who gets the aliyahs. So you'll have a young man, he'll walk in, and when they sell the aliyahs, he says, yeah, 5 shekel, yeah, I'll take the 5 shekel. And then he gets the third aliyah, and then he tells the gabbai, who's a makeshift gabbai, my wife had a baby girl, I want to name her right now. What a nightmare that he is in the context of non-communal activity going through the motions of Misha Berach to name his daughter where he bought the aliyah 5 seconds ago. He's much better off in his community, with his parents, with his whatever, with his family. But we as a people have gotten a little bit away from that, and in big communities that's even harder. So now I'm a little off topic, but let's come back to what you asked. The davening of the congregation is by its reality of a higher caliber than any individual. In other words, the reality is that this is the Jewish people standing as the Jewish people. We all, as individuals, we all have shortcomings. But the people is a very important concept, very beautiful idea. So when the chazan is repeating the Shemona Esrei or whatever he's doing, and he's doing it on our behalf, then I'm part of that group dynamic. The Hasidic world, by the way, pays much greater focus on this. Like they'll say before the performance of mitzvos, I do this in the name of all of the Jewish people. B'shem kol Yisrael. There's these like intentional statements. I want to wrap myself up in the whole people, because the whole people is without iniquity. I am sure I have shortcomings, but the whole Klal Yisrael, I'll give you one example. We all have had things in our lives that we skipped that day. Maybe there's a day we didn't say Shema. But the Jewish people has never skipped a day. Since Shema was uttered by Moshe Rabbeinu, the Jewish people have delivered on their responsibility to say Shema every day since then. When we get up in the morning and we say, at the sea we said, God will reign forever, Hashem Yimloch Olam Vaed, since the day of the sea, people have been saying that. I didn't myself always say it. Sometimes I miss days. But that's chashuv. That's important when Klal Yisrael is there. So when I wrap myself into the congregational ethic, I've lifted myself up big time. And yet that has to be balanced with a sense of, like was spoken about last week, that davening is the work of the heart, and it can't just be going through the motions. So it has to be balanced with, it is resonating with me. But we have to challenge ourselves to meet both of those needs. Not to... There was a fellow who used to daven in a shul not far from here, who didn't get along with other people. And I knew him very well, and he would constantly complain to me about all the problems. He didn't get along with other people. And I told him to catch his attention, because he was coming to me for advice. I said to him, do you own a shofar? He said, yes. I said, that's good. I'm glad you own a shofar. He said, what are you talking about? I said, before long, you will be home on Rosh Hashanah by yourself. So you ought to have a shofar, so that at least you'll be able to fulfill your obligation of hearing the sound of the shofar. Because he couldn't figure out how to
get along
in the dynamic. You know what got me the most? Is when he would complain that he didn't get enough aliyahs. And then he would complain that when he got an aliyah, some people took his seat. I said, so what am I supposed to do for you? So, anyway, I got his attention with the shofar thing, by the way. I got his attention. So you have to find the right dynamic in the halachic framework so that your kavana, your intent, is not disturbed. And yet, you're not retreating into your own space and seeing yourself as only the individual. There's tremendous power in being part of the congregation and being with the people. Okay, so there are laws that govern that. You know, there are laws. So, for example, in Shemona Esrei, you can't stop in the middle. You have to continue. And you can't answer in the middle. But it's more complicated than that. Like if you're only already in the very last paragraph after Hamavarech Adamo Yisrael Bashalom, then there are parts you're allowed to answer. I mean, it requires study to understand what's going on and how to interplay with that. But there's another important thing. You know, a brilliant idea in halacha that applies to our lives constantly is an idea called Shomea Keona. Shomea Keona means that in many areas of Jewish law where I'm required to state something with my own mouth, if I hear it, it's as if I stated it. So for example, everyone's required to say Kiddush, but most people fulfill their obligation by hearing another say Kiddush. Only one is saying Kiddush usually, you know. Even men and men, in other words, your guest someplace or whatever it is, Shomea Keona, I fulfill my obligation. Every Shabbos morning I say Kiddush and everybody else just listens. But that's a concept. That's an amazing thing. And the sages teach us that is dependent on a concept. But in order to tell you what concept that's dependent on, which you've all heard of before, I'm going to tell you another halacha. Fascinating halacha. If I am obligated in something and you are obligated in something, and I have already fulfilled my obligation, under most conditions, I can do it again just in order for you to fulfill your obligation. So like I said Kiddush already, but I can still say Kiddush for you because you're obligated and I'm obligated. That's what we call arevut. Okay? Arevut, or the yeshivish way of saying it is arvus. Okay? So what does it mean? An arev is a cosigner. Somebody who mixes himself into a deal. Okay? This is a loan between the two of you, but you need me as a cosigner. I'm an arev. That's my role. Fascinating word, by the way. I love the word arev. Ayin resh bet. In all places it means mixture. Boom. Kol Yisrael arevim zeh lazeh. All Jews are interdependent. And because we're interdependent, if I fulfilled my obligation already, I can still do it again for you to fulfill your obligation, so long as you're obligated. I'm obligated and you're obligated. And it comes from that principle. Kol Yisrael arevim zeh lazeh. We're all intermingled. Side point about Hebrew. Ayin resh bet means at least the following words. It means cosigner. It means an eruv around a city. It means an Eruv Tafshilin, when you mix foods together before the, what's it called? It means Erev, which means evening. Mariv or Arvit, which means the evening prayer. It means Ma'arav, which means west. It means Orev, which means raven. Okay, it means Orev, which means melodious, like heart, like a beautiful intermingling of a beautiful sound. We say is a kolo arev, his voice is melodious. Okay, so what does it really mean? It really means mixture. It really means mixture. All of the things I just said have to do with mixture. The evening is that mixture between day and night, when light and dark are coming together. It happens in the west. Prayer of the evening derives its name from that, Ma'ariv or Arvit. An Eruv around the city is an intermingling of common property so that it's all viewed as one thing. Eruv Tavshilin is the intermingling of the food prepared on Wednesday afternoon with the food that's going to be prepared on Friday afternoon for the purpose of Shabbos. Okay? All of those words, an Arev, a cosigner, is intermingling, mixing in to the deal. Melodious is when the right high and low pitch and things are coming together in a beautiful way, in an intermingling mixture. Fascinating. Find that in any other language. It doesn't exist. The word Arev means, a raven, my own theory. The raven, if you look closely, is not really black. It's sort of a mixture of black and blue hues, like almost like a purple. Mm-hmm. It looks like the evening sunset, and maybe that's where it gets its name from. Okay, all of these mean intermingling. Okay, I want to bring up another topic with the few minutes that we have left, but then I hope to leave another minute for questions or comments. I was once talking to a young man who really struggled with his own sense that of belief in anything that we typically believe in. Came from a religious family, was not angry at his parents, it seemed. It didn't make sense to him. He didn't believe God gave the Torah at Sinai or didn't believe that God exists or whatever it is. He just struggled with it. So I went with him to see many, many great teachers, many great rabbis to discuss this topic. And he was discussing this with somebody, and he said, how do you know? How are you sure? How are you sure that God, you know, created the world and whatever the set of facts are? Let's call the basic facts maybe. God created the world, gave the Torah to the Jewish people at Sinai, is watching what we're doing. There is a next life. There is an afterlife. There's reward and punishment. Maybe those are the big kind of things. How do you know? Do you really believe? How do you know? He said. So the rabbi said to him something that really made an impact on me. He said, the first thing you need to know is that in life, we really, really, truly, utterly, in complete way, don't know anything. You can't really 100% beyond any doubt know anything. I'll give you an example. There's this woman. She's been telling me for 40 years that she's my mom. Okay? And I have every reason to believe that she is my mom, but how do I really know? Maybe it's been staged. You don't really know that you're at the suite next to the shul. Maybe this is all a hoax. While you were sleeping last night, I built this set. Maybe if you poke through, you'll find out, like in the movie The Truman Show, you'll find out that we're in Boise. And I just set you up, and these are all actors. He just looks like the guy you were sitting next to last week. You don't really know. How can you really know? I've got this guy. He looks so much like me, it's crazy. We speak the same way. The rumor is that we shared the same womb for 9 months. But I don't really know. Maybe they hired him. Maybe he's an actor. He's my identical twin brother, but how do you know? You can't really, 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 absolutely, you don't know. So what do we do? We function with reason. We function based on reason. It is unreasonable for you to believe that this is a hoax. That I'm an actor and I staged this whole thing. It's unreasonable. This guy for sure could be up to a hoax. I handed him my card last night. I had an address. Maybe I made it up. I saw him walking to Walmart. I followed him in and then I said, here's my card. And this, by the way, this doesn't look like a shul, does it? Exactly. So maybe it's all a hoax. We don't know. So I'm bringing up the topic of doubt. Doubt is something everybody has. Reasonable doubt is a different question. Now, maybe next week, with the time available, I'll talk about what drives me personally to believe the things I said before, that the Torah is true, that Hashem exists, that and so on and so forth, that there is reward and punishment, that there is that there are the commands, that we once stood at Har Sinai. These are very important things. I don't know if we could ever see the friend that I brought. He wasn't really functioning in reasonable doubt. He was saying, I'm not willing to address it because I'm not really sure. Everything else in his life he was not really sure about either, but he could do. He was not really sure that law school would pay off for him, but it was a reasonable decision in his life to do it that way, and so far so good. It's paying off for him. You know, we don't know everything. We can't ever really know. And what I'm really trying to do is give you permission to have doubt. My Rebbe, Rabbi Eugen, Zichrono Livracha, used to say that the questions are all good questions. That it's good to have a question. The Mishnah says in Pirkei Avos, Lo habayshan lamed, the one who's embarrassed does not learn. Don't be afraid to ask your question. Don't be afraid. You have a question, it bothers you. How do you really know? Or even simple questions. You say, you know, for years and years and years, they've been using this word mincha. I don't know what it is. So good. It's a good question. If it's a question, it's a good question. Don't be afraid to ask the question. It's a good question. If it's embarrassing, so find the right framework to ask the embarrassing question. Because the one who's too embarrassed to ask doesn't grow, doesn't learn, doesn't progress, and doesn't move the choosing point up because of embarrassment. But doubt is okay. Questions are okay. Let's keep them coming. So let's go for one more. You got a question?
So I was really embarrassed to ask that question.
Okay.
Before, there are certain things I can buy into. I believe that the Torah came from God, delivered Mount Sinai. I believe that.
Okay.
But then some things I find pretty unbelievable and kind of weird.
Okay.
Like concept of Mashiach and people rising from the dead. I picture zombies. It's very confusing for me, and as someone with a science background, I can't make sense of it.
Okay, and those are incredibly important questions. Let me underscore how important they are, okay? The Rambam, in his 13 Principles of Faith, lists those two as number 12 and number 13. So they're big, right? They're big, we hardly ever talk about them, and yet they're very big. And you're asking beautiful questions. I can make an argument for them. Time doesn't really allow fully, okay? But let's just give a little taste of that. I think there exists a realm in our lives that is irrational. There is an irrational realm in our lives. Love, for example, is often functioning irrationally, right? You've heard me say this before. The most irrational of all decisions people make is to put up with their kids. Okay, in other words, what these people, they just show up and all they do is take, right? But we feel a sense of unbelievable passion for them from the moment we see them. And all they are is one big problem at the beginning. You know, feed me, change me, and don't sleep. Okay? So and yet we give to them. So that's irrational. I think that's an irrational realm. I don't think that the scientists will tell you, well, that's because synapse A and B are slamming against each other in that space and whatever it is. And I'm no great student of it, so maybe there are people listening who are saying, no, I can explain that perfectly. But I think it's irrational. It's an example of the realm of irrational. I'm going to write myself a note so that we make sure to talk about this more fully next week. Because I see in my notes I didn't talk about the things I thought about we were going to talk about this week. But I would say you're talking actually about an important leap. There is an important leap that is that the Almighty is beyond my grasp. And it's okay. And I think we ought to be okay with that. Because that's what makes him God. That's what makes him God. If I could fully grasp the Almighty, then I'm the Almighty. And if my behaviors, by the way, will be subject only to what I fully grasp, then I am the final arbiter of morality and of good decisions. So what I'm saying is, all I'm really addressing is that those things which we don't know what they are until we see them, and that's an important idea. The Rambam says in the laws of kings, the Rambam says that the days of Mashiach, what they will be, we don't know what they will be until they are. We don't have a full grasp of what you will see there until it happens. And so I can't tell you exactly what it's going to be. Actually, the zombie imagery probably is a function for all of us on what we've read or seen in movies or whatever it may be. Right? We're influenced by that. We're like right to the thriller, music video or something like that, if that's the right one. I think that's where it is. Right? So that's just what pops in our head because we grew up in the 80s, and that's what they gave us when things rose from the dead, and that we got that imagery in our head. And we get impacted by that. Right? And that too is irrational. So it's a beautiful question and a crucial question, and I want to address it more fully, but what I'm really trying to say is the realm of the irrational, therefore the realm of the divine, is actually going to be part of the process. Accepting that is going to be part of the process of continuing in our development, it seems to me. Okay, friends, I don't think 3 weeks is enough, but we'll meet next week and then we'll see what happens. Okay, we'll stop here.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to torahmediaatlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.